Michael Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
New Scientist, 29th of December 2018. I'm going to try and get through this. This is a week or so old, and it's part of cardiac rehab and refreshing my memory, rebuilding my memory of things. I don't know, a lot of the memories are sort of just a bit woolly, so to speak. Okay, we're getting an article by Leah Serruge. It's also learning to pronounce these names and different words all the time, and getting spelling and all these sorts of things that you wouldn't know about coming across. No insult to you, dear listeners, whoever you might be, you poor sods. Subconscious clues can make us forget things. That's my excuse. Okay, we can forget things when instructed to, even if the instruction is subliminal, it turns out. Oh gosh, this is going to be one of these couple percentage. Oh yeah, okay. We already knew that people can consciously suppress memories when asked to. One experiment used visual clues to tell volunteers to remember or forget words while they tried to learn a variety of word pairs. If told to forget a word, a volunteer was less likely to remember it later on. Mayor Raphael Guillard at the Hospital Saint-Anne in Paris, France, and his colleagues have shown that this work can work sublimely too. The team trained a group of 44 volunteers to remember or forget in response to clear conscious visual clues. They found that volunteers called the second word in a pair 83% of the time if they were given the remember clue when learning it, and only 77% of the time when they had been given the forget clue. Next team ran the same experiment with a twist. The learners trying to learn the new pairs of words with the forget and remember clues were flashed on the screen for periods of time that were too short for anyone to consciously notice them. Researchers found that subconscious clues to forget lowered the average recall rate to 75%, which is lower, compared with 81% when the participants were given conscious clues to remember. This is, it would be like no clues. I'd be interested what no clues at all would be more interesting. This first study proved experimental evidence to provide experimental evidence that some memories are susceptible to unconscious distortions. If something like these may be ultimately lead to new therapies for, oh god, it's like it's artificial intelligence now as opposed to sort of like you've got to tick the box. With post-traumatic stress disorders, helping them to suppress upsetting memories without conscious effort. This would avoid the need for them to consciously revisit their traumatic memories, says Brendan Doop, University of Louisville in Kentucky. Quote, but we are not quite there yet, he says. I was going to say, it's very interesting showing videos to students. They can pick up if things which are subliminal, you know, one or two frames, they see it instantly. One or two students always stop in class. It's really interesting. It's of young minds. It'd be interesting to see the rate at which you see things. Government chats, games, booze, love. Board games, whiskies and polyamory are just some of the things discussed in the UK civil servants on. So this is Government's Chat by Jacob Annon, and there's a Google thing called Slack. You got up here. Okay. Along with their actual works. Like many organisations, including New Scientist, the UK Civil Service has embraced Slack as an alternative to email, but the ephemeral nature of the service could make it harder to hold the government to account. Slack allows organisations to set up multiple chat channels devoted to particular topics. A Freedom of Information request to the Cabinet Office, which oversees Government Digital Services, GDS, reveals that in June 2018, the UK government had 282 Slack channels and 6,723 users, i.e. no one. Okay. As you might expect, Slack seems to have been embraced by civil servants on the tetchier end of the scale. The channels within the most members are dedicated to topics like design, user research and security, but there's also more specific ones that read like a list of tech buzzwords such as cloud computing, GDPR and artificial intelligence. There are just 100 members in the channel about blockchain technology behind cryptocurrencies, bitcoins, that have been touted as the digital solution to almost any problem you can think of. So I know of people who have made absolute fortunes. I know of other people who are just really in love with themselves and lost out bad on Bitcoin. Along with these work-based channels, the details released by the Cabinet Office provide a peek at what it is like inside the civil service. A video games channel encourages people to, quote, chat about all things game-related and maybe organise a game or two, unquote. The board games channel, meanwhile, offers a chat about, quote, games played on a board, or possibly with cards, or miniatures, or whatever, as long as it's not Monopoly. Even a group of 16 diehard Pokemon Go fans have a place to talk. Drinking also features heavily in the list of topics available, with chat rooms that are about coffee, whiskey, and a pub of cot, the traditional British call for post-work beverage. Elsewhere, users can talk about channels set up for books, stickers, photography and other hobbies, or discuss lifestyle interests such as Christianity and polyamory, whatever that means. The government use of Slack has previously been scrutinised by the UK data watchdog, the Information Commissioner's Office, as potentially conflicting with the legal duties surrounding record keeping. In 2016, an individual made a Freedom of Information request for all the information held on the GDS Slack platform. The Cabinet Office refused the request, stating that Slack is not used for official capacity, but the individual pushed back and ultimately raised a complaint with the ICO, which published a ruling on the matter in July 2017. The Cabinet Office said that in April 2017, the GDS Slack contained more than 308,000 messages. Okay. And that because it was using a free version of Slack, it was not possible to export all the messages or separate relevant information from meaningless chat. Freedom of information legislation places a limit on the amount of time that can be dedicated to a particular request. Meaning ICO ruled that the Cabinet Office did not have to release the full chat history. The ICO did, however, note that the government use of Slack raises a number of complicated and novel issues in respect to compliance with the requirements of FIRA, Freedom of Information Act, including wider issues related to record management. The ICO told New Scientist that its work in an area is ongoing, and the Cabinet Office declined to comment. Bloody hell. Which is true. People do not understand the importance of government record. You know, the teachers in schools, that you can't alter records. They just don't understand it. Okay, there's a picture here, Nissan Technology, by Franz Joseph. Oh, I was going to say Franz Joseph Land, Russia. So there's a little polar bear sitting out there on the ice floe. Yes, it does. Looking pretty horrible. Okay, polar bears at risk from polluted ice. Do you think ice or fish stock? Fish, surely they won't get, the polluted ice is not a problem. Surely the fish that they eat would be the problem. Okay, but let's see what he says. It's Adam Popescu. As our boat bobs in a windy iceberg-filled cove, I try to gauge the skinniness of a polar bear in front of me. So he is a New Scientist reporter, really going. It isn't plum, but I've seen bears in worse health. We're in Franz Josef Land, the remote part of Russia between the Barents Sea and the Arctic Ocean. Well, I just see the picture there. I wonder what that is. I really don't understand. It's like there's a picture here. I don't quite understand where it is and what it means. They've said Greenland, Danish territory. Mm-hmm. Late summer, there are lots of polar bears, walruses and seabirds, and plenty of ice. Unlike the permanent sea ice a few hundred kilometres to the north, the ice calves off from glaciers such as they shrink and grow in annual cycles, creating floating sculptures that our boat manoeuvres around to get a better look at the bear. While offshore bears follow the sea ice, hunting seals on ice floes all year round, bears that live along the coastline spend their summers on land and are forced to forage for whatever they can find. Relying on sporadic low-calorie meals such as eggs, you think they would be from nesting guillemot or sucars, it's harder for these bears to pack on the pounds. The bears I see seem to be doing okay, if a little scheme. The slimmer bears may appear less healthy than their bigger offshore cousins, but the fact might be the other way around. Researchers recently found that the the offshore bears around the Barents Sea are some of the most polluted animals on Earth. This is a direct consequence of the seals they eat to bulk up. So it's not polluted ice, it's polluted seals. I would have thought so. Over a period of 14 years, Heli Aorti of the Norwegian Polar Bear Institute and her colleagues studied 152 bears living around the Franz Josef Land nearby and the nearby Norwegian archipelago of Svalbard. They found the offshore female bears were in better condition, having greater body mass than coastal females, but on average their levels of pollutants such as perfluoroalkyl substances, PFAs, so their neurocells, are 33% higher. PFSA are used to make products including carpeting and metal plating that are toxic and degrade extremely slowly at frozen poles, as you would expect. These and other organic chemical pollutants probably originate from factories in China, Russia, Poland, and India, no longer in Australia. It's interesting that most of the sea plastic comes from China. It's just bucketed out, and no one makes a comment about it. It almost exclusively comes from China and Philippines and stuff like that. Okay. They find their way to the Arctic via currents, where they fall in the snow, of Arctic air currents, and accumulate in the ice. Which is true. As the ice melts every summer, the PFAs are released into the water, where they enter the food chain. They eventually make their way to the fatty deposits and keep the seal warms from there into bears that eat them. So, I'm going to make a small point. If it falls at snow, that takes a while before it turns to ice, but okay. The biggest challenge is to figure out what these chemicals do to the health of the offshore bears, said Rorty. The bears are extremely complex. A contaminated bear isn't necessarily unhealthy, she says. Yeah, which is, I think they're really trying to pull strings here. Yet previous research on the eastern Greenland has linked chemical exposure to brain damage in bears and even breakages of the baculum, the penis bone, which is a rather bad thing. It's pretty amazing that bears have a penis bone. During my 15 days in Franz Josef Island, I saw 5 bears all along the coast. Each looked relatively healthy. There are signs that some bears along the coast are coping with global warming-induced ice loss relatively well. The bears in Svalbard so far seem to have been handling the sea loss. That's sea ice loss, says Andrew Dorsch of the University of Baltic Canada, who worked with Royalty on this study. Quote, but I'll bet that's going to change given the extreme rate of ice loss in the area. Thanks for knowing what a researcher bets. There's more trouble for polar bears ahead as exploration across the Arctic also looks set to rise. Canadian firms mine inside the Arctic Circle, and China's Arctic policy includes bankrolling and mining in Greenland in an effort to encourage autonomous dangerous territories independence movement. Oh gosh. So China's trying to destabilize Greenland from Denmark. An independence movement. Oh, you can imagine that. That's an amazing thing. China claims parts of Greenland seabed, and multiple nations are stepping up their military activities in the region as the situation the US Coast Guard has likened to a land grab is going on in the South China Sea. That's what I'd say, like the Chinese South China Sea. Poor Greenland, China destabilizing. No one knows how these tensions will play out, but there is one certainty for the bears and their home. Yet more change. That's the biggest threat of all for ecosystems this fragile. Well, that was an entertaining thing. I didn't realise that there's a Greenland independence movement. I think they should form an allegiance with some Arab states and stuff like that. Okay. We're into page 18. A very interesting picture of an octopus. In fact, you could look at this for hours quite. It's just such a beautiful creature. The octopus's eyes, but that horizontal slits. It's pretty amazing they've evolved that way. And in fact, the octopus is an amazing thing. It's got a thing. Okay. I remember an article. This is the octopuses. If you feed them MDMA, which I'll see if I can remember the formula for it again, it becomes amorous, and they hold tentacles, is the general story. But let's listen to this. An octopus on ecstasy gets all sociable and huggy. And this hasn't got an author with it. Octopuses given the drug ecstasy become more gregarious and try to hug, quote-unquote, other octopuses. In fact, they respond in a similar manner to people who use the drug, suggests the molecular basis for social behavior evolved to a share and system more than 50 million years ago, which is interesting. So 50 million years ago is prior to, it doesn't suggest it, does it? There's co-evolution, you know. So it's got eyes, we've got eyes, but they've evolved separately. Not separately. It's evolution can come to the same solution. So this is incorrect. This is one of the things that the mollusk's eye and brain system have evolved separately into, like snails, if it can't turn into octopuses, and they've got a lot of the same structures, so the same solutions have evolved several different times. So I don't think that's true what they're saying. Gull Doan at the John Hopkins University School of Medicine in Maryland says octopuses are usually solitary animals. During reproduction, they are social for 3 minutes while they mate, and then go back to wanting to kill each other, she says. I love that one. To test the impact of ecstasy or MDMA on the behaviour, Dolan and her colleagues at the Marine Biological Laboratory in Massachusetts set up an aquarium with a central chamber of two sides. An octopus in a perforated container was put in one side of the chamber. On the other, an object that was identical container. In the centre was an octopus that could roam. Normally, the roaming octopus spent little time in the chamber with the other octopus and touched its container cautiously. But if it was put in the water, containing dissolved ecstasy, MDMA, before being placed in the test aquarium, it spent much longer with the other octopus and tried to huck it in a way that seemed exploratory rather than aggressive. None of the animals appeared to be stressed during the experiment. Now, I must admit, the octopus, they do have a story. These are unusual. So I've had friends, marine biologists, who've worked with octopuses. And this is a story of in Melbourne, in the Central Museum, they had octopuses, and the octopuses would try to escape their tanks and actually work their way out of rooms and out windows and go into the street to escape. One of the things is that octopuses have no long-term memory. You can't actually train an octopus to do anything. I don't know whether that's true. And a similar little story is that, there was a feeling that the octopuses were quite eerily intelligent. And the thing is that people trying to keep white pond sharks, they just will not go in captivity. They will not go in an aquarium, they will ram themselves to death to try and get them out. It's pretty amazing. But that's a very similar species of shark, like a bull shark you can keep. Pillar-sized robot can check out your gut. This is a standard thing. It's a beautiful, this is one of the things I do show at school, as a pillar-sized robot going in and it does the digestive system really quickly. A robotic capsule designed to suck up the mucus will hopefully end the need for uncomfortable seizures to sample it. Oh yeah, that's good. The gut mucus can be a more accurate indicator of health than a stool sample. Oh, God. But getting it usually involves inserting a long tube called an endoscope into the digestive tract. Capsules are made a good alternative as they are easy to swallow and get to spots that the endoscope struggle to reach. Li Zhang of the Chinese University of Hong Kong and his colleagues have built a prototype robotic capsule that has a vacuum bag for sucking up the mucus. When the capsule is in place, a magnet outside the body can trigger an electric current which melts the wax plugs to open the vacuum bag. Okay. Oh. You would hope that it's an RF signal. Oops, far out. Get away, you birds. So the birds having a bit of a fight around here. But what I was going to say is that you'd hope it would be inductive heating rather than a magnet doing it. I think that's poorly described. The mucus sucked into the bag and the capsule is excreted with its cargo. Zhang has yet to test the device in animals, but plans to do so. So, basically, he's got a piece of a pill with a... that's just crazy. Mozzies may spread plastic pollution. And this is interesting because you can actually just, if you've got a piece of metal, you can detect it, not with complex stuff, with a metal detector. Mosquitoes may spread plastic pollution. That's interesting. Mosquito larvae living in water contaminated with plastic accumulate the litter in their bodies and retain some of it even after they become flying adults. The worry is that plastic may get into animals outside the aquatic food chain. Plastic pollution is ubiquitous, but it's especially common in the water. Birds, fish and other animals living around the aquatic systems can ingest small pieces by accident. But plastic's impact may spread further by animals if the life cycle that involves living in the water and then on land. Amanda Callaghan of the University of Reading, UK, and her colleagues suspected that mosquitoes could do just this. To test the idea, they fed 149 aquatic mosquito larvae with a mix of food and microplastics. Yeah, I hope they named them all. Ding, ding. They examined 15 individuals selected at random with a wild larva, another 15 when the animals had turned into flying adults. The team found microplastics in all 30 on average. There's more than 3,000 bits of plastic in each larva. As the animal matured, they gradually stopped eating microplastics and destroyed most of them. Even so, adults still had contained about 40 bits. Like, less than 1%. Okay. Big and hairy woos male at bug's ball. That sounds beautiful. Isn't that beautiful? Beautiful. Byline. Female dance flies, large inflatable sacs and hairy legs are the look when they go to the ball. The insects get their name because they seem to dance in the air in mating swarms. Rosalind Maryland, oh, I've seen that, and her colleagues in University of Toronto, Mississauga, so I know that district, you often have to visit friends out there in Canada, and the University of Stirling, UK, have now revealed how females attract a mate. They inflate sacs along the abdomen to make their bodies look bigger. Hair like scales on the legs also make the females look larger. The team found that males find females with big sacs 3 times more attractive than with small sacs. But if the sacs are small, hairy legs help. Well, there you go. Look at this. This got, you would not believe. I've got this amazingly red, crimson rosella. It's fairly, and it looks in good health. Look at these birds. Look, they're absolutely toxic little rats of the air. I shouldn't say all of these birds can carry some pretty lethal viruses and stuff like that. How a swarm of bees acts as one, page 19 as we go through. A swarm of honeybees hanging from a branch can change its shape in bad weather. Now we know more about how the bees work as a single superorganism to do this. Colonies of European honeybees reproduce by releasing a queen with thousands of workers. This swarm often attaches itself to a branch in an inverted cone with a queen at the center. Researchers now know the cone can change shape to cope with winds typically becoming flatter. To understand how individual bees work together to do this, Orit Pleg of Harvard University and her colleagues put a bee cluster under a board in their laboratory and shook it to mimic the stress of high winds. The cone cluster began to sway and started to flatten, losing half of its height in 30 minutes. This made it less prone to sway. By filming the swarm and tracking individual bees, the team discovered that those near the tip of the cone slowly climb up and spread out, flattening the structure. Okay, so if I'm swaying, let's move the less sway part, and so the whole thing gets less sway. By simulating the physical process the individual bees experience when the swarm shakes, the researchers showed that when bees are physically strained as they cling together, it's possible, they say, that shaking-related physical strain acts as a cue to climb upwards and flatten the cone. God. That's... How you got an article for that? That's pretty amazing. A drug that prunes useless brain cells may halt mouse dementia. Well, hopefully that will help me. Purchasing brain cells that are worn out but won't die could provide a new way to treat and prevent Alzheimer's disease and other types of dementia. We also hope after research in engineered mouse showing that if these kinds of senescent cells are eradicated, as they develop, the animals' brains are protected against the ongoing degeneration which they are prone. Darren Baker at the Mayo Clinic of Minnesota, who led the study, says this shows that sentient cells promote neurodegeneration and cognitive loss. Preventing these cells from accumulating attenuates the disease, he says. Mice are genetically engineered so their brains degenerate from a young age, becoming clogged with fibers and tau tangles, which are present in people with dementia. Baker's team discovered that by the time the mice were a year old, they also accumulated a lot of senescent cells in their brains. Compared with healthy mice, they had a dozen times more many of these types of cells in the memory centers of the hippocampus and twice as many in the cortex, the thinking hub of the brain. To find out if the sentient cells also drive the tau-related brain degeneration, the researchers bred a tau tangled prone mouse with whose sentient cells could be destroyed as they emerged using a drug called AP, whatever that stands for, wiping out the sentient skills, halted brain degeneration in the crossbred mouse and prevented loss of memory and cognitive abilities, usually seen in a mouse with tau tangles. Poor little mice, they come along and they're just so cute but can't get out of the maze anymore. It's about me. Okay, genetic therapy for cocaine addiction. That sounds absolutely like you in the modern age. Yeah, so if you're a Stone Age person, you wouldn't get cocaine. Now you get cocaine, but you also get genetic therapy. People hooked on cocaine may soon be invited to test therapy designed to destroy the drugs their body if they take it again. There are no approved treatments for cocaine addiction. It is hoped the new therapy using genetically engineered cells may help tackle the 5,000 annual cocaine overdose deaths in the US. It's like it's always going. Let's call for arms, let's do it. If something's really dodgy, you have people say nodgy and then have a really hard to interpret statement about how it's dodgy, but this is interesting. Skin cells taken from people undergoing treatment and altered to constantly make an enzyme that destroys cocaine in the blood. The cells could then be multiplied and implanted under the recipient's skin. So this is like, you could either just take away the cocaine or you could just make it useless for the poor little people. Ming Zhu of the University of Chicago and his colleagues trialed the technique with mice. Hopefully there's not sentient mouse, so you could just use those mice that live above. Within 20 minutes, 6 mice with the implants had nearly eliminated a dose of cocaine, while 6 control mice took almost 2 hours. Whee! Unlike control animals, the treated mice didn't get cocaine-related pleasure hit. Zhu expects the treatment to work in people. Prototype versions of engineered human cells made of the enzyme continuously for at least 2 months. We'd like to move to clinical trials as soon as possible, wouldn't you? A hair loss remedy to be sniffed at. treating hair loss, bloody hell, may longer mean pills, injections or transplants, just a whiff of synthetic sandalwood. Olfactory receptors that detect odors are found in the nose. Da-da! I thought they were found in the elbows. But similar receptors crop up in other parts of the body. Well, there you go, including the skin and the hair follicles. Here they play a role of functions including healing. Well, there you go, I'm stupid. So, smell receptors. So these chemical detectors, God. Ralph Powers of the University of Manchester, UK, and his colleagues say the evidence that forming a hair uses similar sets of molecular tools as making new skin after being wounded. This makes them wonder whether activating one of these receptors could promote hair growth. Right, you're wondering about yourself, I think, a new scientist. To test the idea, researchers exposed human scalp samples to synthetic sandalwood for 6 days. They chose this scent because it was a molecule highly likely to bind with the receptor. They found a 25-30% hike in the hormone needed for hair growth in the samples. The death cells of cells involved in forming hair declined. The synthetic sandalwood, already widely used in cosmetics, would be applied to the scalp to promote hair growth. Team says natural sandalwood doesn't work. Why doesn't it work? They just said it doesn't. Alright, that's good enough for me. Why would it be artificial natural? I just don't understand. Okay, so this is a Insight article by Claire Wilson called Insight Fat Acceptance. Big, bold and body positive. Growthing calls for fat acceptance fly in the face of medical advice, but being overweight is actually that bad for your health? Asks Claire Wilson. I think, well, it is for mine. And I've got to really strive to knock it into the head. 31 minutes in. Women's Glossy magazine. Oh, sorry. Yes, speak bold and body positive, Claire Wilson. Women's glossy magazines often get flack for promoting unhealthy beauty ideals, but usually it's because their models are so thin. Not so for this month's issue of Cosmopolitan, which features a plus-side model Tess Holliday, resplendent in green satin underwear. Well, there you go. You've got to wear your underwear. I hope she had clothes on top of it. Holliday's success in modelling, despite her size 26 figure, epitomises the burgeoning, quote, body positive movement, which says people's weight is their own business and has no more, and that no one should dislike the way they look. This is true, the Dutch really got into those Rubens women. Quote, if I saw a body like mine on this magazine when I was a young girl, it would have changed my life, quote, Holliday said when she posted the cover on Instagram. Well, yeah, I suppose it would have, especially if you saw yourself on a magazine. It'll be a bit freaky. Yet there are many downsides to the idea of fat acceptance, as it's sometimes called. Doctors want to warn people about the physical risk of being overweight, not only for the sake of their personal health, but also because the wider impacts on medical budgets. There are so fat, they come into casualty that it takes a team of people to get them up on the operating theatre table. So does fat acceptance mean we clash between people's health and their happiness? And if so, which should take the priority? Oh, heaps of questions buzzing in this person's head. This is an issue that goes beyond the one magazine cover, as almost all countries are seeing rising numbers of their citizens classed as overweight. Obesity is a top public health problem facing most Western nations. It's interesting that the Germans come over here and say, oh, you Aussies, you're all fat, and there's a lot of fatness if you look around in Australia. We have long known that being significantly overweight comes with certain health risks, such as higher rates of heart attacks. More recently, we have found that just being moderately overweight makes people more prone to developing diabetes, which can lead to complications such as foot amputation and blindness. Okay. As a result, people who are overweight are often face a lecture from their doctors about slimming down, even if they are visiting for unrelated reasons. Some UK family doctors now advise their patients to use commercial weight loss programs like Weight Watchers. They wouldn't have any accounts or interest in it, of course. No way. Wider society is also adopting an increasing moralistic tone about the health and fitness. Early this year, UK magazine called The Big Issue urged readers to take, quote, a pledge to exercise and take better care of themselves to avoid being a drain on the National Health Service. Quote, there's an atmosphere where it's okay to publicly criticise overweight people, says Margaret McCartney, a doctor at Glasgow, UK. Cosmopolitan was admonished by both internet trolls and TV journalist Piers Morgan for promoting unhealthy eating when it put a holiday on the cover. Hopefully, they weren't going to eat her. People say, oh, I'm going to eat that person, but no. But can we be so concerned about the health toll? Take the current campaign from the UK charity Cancer Research UK, Croc, with ads depicting chips and like cigarettes in a packet. The charity says obesity is a cancer risk comparable to smoking and that in future the risk of from obesity may be greater. Sophie Harkin, a comedian who founded the Danish Fat Acceptance Organisation, says campaigns aren't justified by medical evidence. The studies cited by Crook show correlations between being overweight and a higher risk of certain cancers, but not being overweight causes those cancers. Some of these might underlie both, such as the lack of exercise or being poor. Even if being overweight really doesn't cause cancer, it does play a particularly big role. According to Crux's own figures, obesity can be linked to just 6% of tumours. That's a lot, I'd say. The ad campaign could leave cancer patients thinking that they are to blame for the illness when they're not. Okay, that's a bit of a brain twister. That's because people are just really bad at crap at statistics, mate. You're Claire Wilson. Cancer isn't the only risk from being overweight, but the wider health consequences of obesity, such as increased risk of heart disease, diabetes, are not always as dramatic as the health warning suggests. Also, if you're overweight, it's harder to do exercise. You know, the hills are hard to get up. Okay, one study found that people in the 60s and 70s who have a body mass of 30 and over, classed as medically obese, lose just one extra year of life on average, see the graphic below. The size of the effect is larger for those who are younger because they have more life to lose. So if you are 20 to 30 and you lose about 6 years of life, it isn't just about lifespan, of course, it's also about extra toll on health. While people are still alive, obese people in their 20s lose about 13 years of healthy life, while very obese people at the same age lose about 19 compared with the recommended weight. So, hang on, does that seem, what you've said is just worth doing? I'm going to have to try and do it. So if you have severe alcohol, you're going to lose 25 years. Poverty is about 8. Smoking, 10. Being overweight, this is a balance, takes a toll on your health. But it's not some other lifestyle factors. These figures all come from different studies and are not strictly comparable. They're based on correlations. The characteristics have been linked to early death rather than proven as the cause. Oh, crap. Please don't show this stuff to me. Okay. Now, costly calories. The extra years spent in poor health cost the health service money. As such, many argue that public health bodies should warn people about the medical consequences of being overweight. That said, there are other behaviours that are likely to cost health services money, such as parachuting. They don't attract public vitriol or reserve for being overweight. Ah, dear. Being lonely correlates with higher rates of heart disease too. Surely no one chooses to be lonely, but no one chooses to be fatter either. Oh, gosh, it's a bit willy. There's no flaw in telling people to lose weight. It ignores the fact there's no simple way to achieve this long term. Well, simply eating less, I would say, and exercising more. The exact figures are unclear, but most people who go on a diet put the weight back on, often end up heavier than they were. That's sad. My overall thing is that if you're on an overall trend of increasing weight, according to one study, people following the Weight Watchers program, just 1 in 5 were still at their goal weight 2 years later. Great money spinner. Why is it so hard to keep it off? When someone loses any significant amount of weight, their body goes through several changes. Hormone shifts that people feel hungrier than they used to after a set amount of food. Their metabolism slows, so to the same calorie intake that previously kept weight steady now piles on the pun, says Tracy Mann, University of Minnesota. Quote, if it doesn't make it impossible to keep the weight off, but it makes it just harder. The only weight loss method shown to work long-term is gastric surgery, where the stomach or gut is made smaller, but surgery is a drastic method, with the operation itself carrying risks. In many countries, it's restricted to people who are morbidly obese. What else? What can everyone else do? There's another way, says Mann. Work towards improvements in health, not weight. If people can adopt a healthy lifestyle, they could see improvements in their blood pressure and blood sugar levels, making heart disease and diabetes less likely. I would actually think that's actually said as well, a healthy lifestyle. Even if they don't lose weight, exercise has the benefits if you don't lose 1 pound, says Mann. That's a really good broad point. Such an approach clashes with the belief that everyone who is overweight must be unhealthy, but there is... I can't see. That's illogical to me, mate. But there's growing evidence to suggest that it isn't true. Certainly people who are overweight are more likely to have high blood pressure, cholesterol, blood sugar, but not all do. By some estimates, as many as a third of people who are overweight have good scores in these measures. Doctors should switch from recommending weight loss to advising people about exercise and healthy eating, says Mann. Fat acceptance campaigners such as Hagen says it's not even ethical to tell people to diet. Quote, I don't know a single fat person who hasn't been on a diet. I've tried the majority in my life. Why not work with the body I have now? Well, she is... okay. But Yoni Freehoff, who heads the Bariatric Medical Institute in Ottawa, Canada, says fat acceptance groups become dangerous when they dismiss dieting. Quote, they say it's impossible and unnecessary to lose weight. That ignores the challenges of quality of life of individuals who are dramatically obese. While Friedhoff accepts that significant weight loss is rare, he says efforts is worthwhile for those who do manage it. A sizable minority succeed at losing and keeping off more than modest amounts, such as 5 to 10% of their starting weight, which can be helpful. I've seen people who've lost 5% who have come off various medications, said Friedhoff. Certainly any decision to try to lose weight has to be an individual one, taking into account the people's past and current health status and their personal feelings. What frustrates Harkin is that while commenters may couch their criticism as self-concerns, she suspects they really just enjoy judging and finger-wagging. I like doing a good old finger wag. I actually am not a good critic. I just love getting out my finger and doing a big wag. A quote, people hate fat people, and they fear becoming fat. It's the worst thing you can be. But personally, she has had it with strangers offering her medical advice over the internet. I don't owe anyone my health. It's my body. Well, I don't know. Just probably saying, what issue can we talk about now? We want to balance. Don't want to get that off the agenda to shut people up. Elon Musk again. Leah Crane. Okay, we're going 43 minutes. Floor and order. Was that a... That wasn't a major article. A discipline schedule may benefit some students, but there's more to life success than turning up on time, says Michael Brooks. Okay. Get ready for the next trend in education theory. A new paper examining the habits of students at the University of Electronics Science and Technology in China suggests that orderliness predicts academic performances. This study uses activities logged on students' cards to show that keeping a regular schedule indicated by showering and eating at the same time every day correlated with high grades. Diligence, as measured by the amount of time spent in teaching buildings and libraries, showed a similar positive correlation. For all the headlines and even policies, that finding is likely to generate it pays to be orderly and diligent in our own analysis. Oh, what a crazy, what a lovely thing. Oh, gotcha. The first and most obvious flaw is to believe that good grades are the harbingers of success, and the UK government has been particularly gullible in this, seduced time and again by the lure of high rankings in international tests such as PISA and TIMSS that measure academic achievements amongst school students. Certain Asian countries like China, Singapore, South Korea, for example, do very well here, outperforming most Western nations. Yet research shows that achieving stellar grades is no guarantee of success in life, or creativity, or a future economic achievement. Though we think we would rather like to do well in PISA, we think if we can't do well in PISA, it must mean something. The UK, for instance, may not produce students that rank highly as PISA hierarchy, but it does consistently turn out people who are world-class in technological hardware, software, and film industry, music, and fine arts. All they list say they do. I think if you've got this huge populations. And it's just a stupid argument. This person is putting a stupid argument. So let's be dumber. If we want success here, we might do better to encourage disorder in our schools. And that's one of the things, one of the amazing truths about learning, the way we learn, is that book says that disorder helps people learn a bit better. Kathleen Voltz at the University of Minnesota showed in 2013 that people's ideas are more creative and interesting when they are working in a messy room. 2 years later, Bob Finnis and Jacob Winberg of the University of Groningen in the Netherlands showed a messy environment helps people focus on reaching clear, well-defined goals. I would actually say, and there's heaps of actual research for that one. That's true. Einstein's desk on the day he died was a mess of clutter. Steve Jobs' workspace, too, was far from pristine. Mark Twain and Zuckerberg offer similar insights. There are clearly strong associations between messy working environments and getting things done. And not always good things, I admit. Donald Trump often appears behind a cluttered desk. But we do have to admit that Trump is creative and productive, albeit in many ways we find troubling. The last thing anyone needs is a truckload of government education theorists announcing students who deviate from the norm will be excluded on the basis they are compromising the institution's ranking. By all means, encourage daily hygiene, but also remember that conformity and uniformity are the enemies of true success. Michael Brooks, a consultant at New Scientist. I think the amazing truth about how we learn is a book which I might read or get permission to podcast. Okay. We're going to 47 minutes. Every pill you take, drugs that send data to doctors risk patients' privacy. Say I, Glenn Cohen, and is I, Dr. Glenn Cohen, and Alex Perlman. That sounds wacko. Your next prescription might include pills that are embedded sensors that can collect and transmit data on whether you're taking them as instruction. Smart pills like these are part of a digital medicine, which also include things like insulin pumps that allow continuous glucose monitoring. The hope is that such products will provide doctors with information about patients between visits and assist agencies and researchers monitor the health outcomes. Many, though, have reacted to the products with fear and concern, and many bioethical issues have been raised. It will be a challenge to ensure that people understand the user's agreements for the battery changes, sensor replacement and software updates involved, and because the devices will capture data, and there is thorny issues about data ownership. Although much of the attention has been focused on gathering data on people who use digital machines, these devices also generate data on physicians and other providers for medical services. Insurers and hospital systems can learn what extent a provider is ensuring patients adhere to treatment regimes. Moreover, provider behavior is response to alerts and other information may become important. For malpractice claims, if people experience adverse effects and lawyers seek to access the records. Well, this is interesting, but surely knowing the truth is good. Some people undergo directly observed treatments for tuberculosis, for example, which involves the doctor watching them take their medication. It's a digital medicine that is a digital medicine an encroachment on the freedom or welcome less intrusive option? Digital medicine products have the potential to improve health care for all involved. But ethicist companies and healthcare providers must work hard to maintain a patient's trust, as you would. We must be transparent about how the data on both patients and providers is collected, how it is used, and the rights people have once the data has been collected. We must also ensure that people are making informed, voluntary choices to use this technology. Arjun Clone is the faculty director of Harvard's Petri Fromm Center from the Health Law Policy, Biotechnology and Bioethics. He's acted as a consultant to Osata Pharmaceuticals advising the use of digital medicine. Ms. Perman is a journalist and bioethicist. Yes, you would be. What's your job? Oh, I'm a bioethicist. Probably everyone is an ethicist. Analysis. SpaceX's moon mission. Gee, he is just... What a... Just... How can he do it? He's got the black t-shirt of Steve Jobs, doesn't he? This is a picture of Elon Musk. Why a trip to the moon is the ultimate luxury. Lee Crame. The first private voyage of SpaceX's planned Big Falcon rocket, BFR, Big Fucking Rocket, will be the ultimate artist's retreat. SpaceX CEO Elon Musk announced on the 17th of December that Yusuke Manzawa, pictured above to the right, it's a man, a Japanese billionaire and art curator who founded Japan's largest online clothing retailer, will be the first passenger on the enormous rocket as he plans to make the voyage around the moon a work of art. It just blows up. Quote, I'd like to invite 6 to 8 artists from around the world to join me on a mission to the moon, says Mezuwaka. Quote, the artist will be asked to create something after the return to Earth. And these masterpieces will inspire the dreamers within all of us. Look, I just have got heaps of problems with all of this. He's also invited Musk along on the journey around the moon and back. Okay, so Musk is not going to do that. To which Musk responded, maybe I'll would join on this trip. I don't know. He can't, because he knows he's going to blow his stuffing out. The spaceship will sit atop a rocket and is planned to hold about 100 people. However, this flight will have a much smaller crew to leave room for extra fuel and supplies just in case anything goes wrong, said Musk. The flight is scheduled for 2023. Well, stone the crows. If that's true, I'll just eat my this New Scientist magazine. But Musk is known for coming up with overly optimistic timescales. Take the timeline with a grain of salt, says Todd Harrison, Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C. May not happen, or may not happen for a long time. In February 2017, SpaceX announced that it would send 2 passengers around the moon in the Falcon Heavy rocket in 2018. But those plans have never materialized. Musk revealed during the announcement of his new flight that Maslow is one of the original passengers, but it's not clear what happened to the other. At the time, Musk has said that 1 or 2 private trips a year could provide 10 to 12% of SpaceX annual revenue. Quote, it's a way of funding his longer-term ambitions, says Harrison. If he gets billionaires that want to do it with a drill, it allows him to build these spacecrafts and test them to his vision of going to Mars. Oh, Christ. I mean, God, seriously. Musk declined to reveal how much Mazda paid for the seats on the BFR trip, but he says it will be enough to, quote, have a material effect on paying for the cost of the development of the BFR. He also said the total development cost of the rocket will be about $5 billion. So it's got to be less than $5 billion, and probably more than $500 million. Something like that. Okay. But just take the launch of the red Tesla car aboard the first flight of the Falcon Heavy rocket in February. These pleasure cruises may be more style than substance. It's a marketing strategy similar to those of Earthbound luxury bands, as Laura Grego of the Union Concerned Scientists of Massachusetts is not bloody well concerned. The real profit center for fashion designers is not the clothes they walk on the runway. They create a brand persona, and that way they make their money from handbags and perfumes. The flight is higher stakes, has a higher stakes than a fashion show, though. Pulling off with SpaceX a major reputation boost, but if anything went awry, it would be a disaster for the firm, as well as the passengers. Oh, you don't say. I think the probability of... Okay, this is so remote. It would be astonishingly bad if something went wrong, not just for SpaceX, but for space tourism industry, which is just an infancy, said Harrison. It would scare people off, and if there is an accident, it will attract much more government oversight and regulation. I suppose... Yeah, I suppose you have a duty of care. Okay, going here. Okay. Aperture, whatever this means. Life, the universe, and everything. More than 35,000 visitors, 120 speakers, and 100 immersive experiences added up to one forgettable weekend of New Scientist Live, Valerie Jamison. Picks her highlights. Stephen Hawking once visited a karaoke club in Los Angeles where he sang a duet with a Nobel Prize winning physicist. The song Yellow Submarine by the Beatles. Marika Taylor, who had Hawking as her PhD supervisor in the University of Cambridge, recounted the tale in a discussion exploring Hawking's life, working and legacy. She fondly explained how Hawking always put his students first and had no qualms about keeping politicians and media waking while he discussed physics with them. These were some of the fascinating personal insights visitors to New Scientist Live at Excel London were treated to at the weekend. My own spine-tingling moment came when European Space Agency astronaut Tim Peake shared his experience with jungle explorer William Millard and Nikki Witherell, who led the first all-female expedition to trek across Antarctica using muscle power alone. The packed audience was gripped by their incredible stories and their humility. Although the three had never met before, they bonded immediately. Don't be surprised to hear them in arrange an expedition to Antarctica in the future. Similarly, in discussions on the role of technology in sport, you could see the future collaboration forming between sports engineer Stephen Hack and wheelchair racing champion Hannah Croft. His brain whirred into overdrive as she explained how little research had development gone into improving equipment for para-athletes' use. Carlo Rovelli blew everyone's minds describing the mysteries of time. Marine biologist John Copley introduced us to Coffs crab, a species that lives in deep Arctic waters that feeds on combining comb bacteria trapped in its hairy chest. Oh, that's interesting. The Harvard University geneticist David Rich, a pioneer in the analysis of ancient DNA, gave one of his rare public talks explaining how the latest finding overturned existing ideas of who we are and where we came from. His work paints an extraordinary picture of us as a mosaic of other human species of the human migration across the globe. On the show floor, more than 1,000 people made slime, oh God, and learned about the material science behind this year's biggest trend. Robots mingled with prehistoric shaman visitors, ground flower and stone age way, and the virtual reality roller coaster led our brains and bodies to believe we were doing the real thing. Thank you to the 35,000 people who came to the show and made it such a success. New Scientist subscribers were able to watch the videos on any of the talks they missed. Look out for details soon. Now that's just advertising. Didn't we do a fantastic job? That's it. Okay, that ends this, and we're doing yet another hour or so podcasting to get through this, and then I've got the next magazine, and I've got just so much to do. Thanks a lot for listening.
Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.